Good morning. Thank you all for coming today. I'm Steve Morrison, director of the CSIS Global Health Policy Center, and we're thrilled today to be able to host Peter Piot for this, what I think is very timely speech. I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. The center aspires to have a very active speaker series of prominent individuals like Peter to come and share with us their views of what's been achieved in this last decade and where we are today and looking forward, what are the major challenges. I want to especially thank some of my colleagues at the center for their help in pulling this together. Suzanne Brundage, Eric Little, Kate Hoffler put a lot of effort into this. I also want to thank the Kaiser Family Foundation, Jennifer Cates, Alicia Carbo, for working with us in the web stream broadcasting of this event. And there will be a transcript posted on both the CSIS, the web stream and the transcript on both the CSIS site as well as the Kaiser Family Foundation site. We're also being recorded today by C-SPAN, so look for the broadcast of that later today and into the week. Peter is known to all of you. He is such an indomitable and charismatic and passionate personality. He's been such a high-impact leader on HIV/AIDS and related issues now over the last 12 years in which he's led UNAIDS, where he's been the executive director since its founding and Under Secretary General of the United Nations. He's both an MD and a PhD in microbiology. He holds the honor of having been the co-discoverer of Ebola virus in 1976. He began his career really as a scientist in Central Africa and generated a prodigious body of scientific research in that period, which many of us are unaware of, having known him really in this more recent phase of his life. He's really a unique voice in the spectrum of people who have worked on HIV/AIDS globally in this last decade. Both the respect and balance and passion that he's brought to this, he is a person who creates consensus, who takes on really difficult issues around social justice and gender and stigma, who's been an advocate across the board for moving forward the agenda on treatment, prevention, on sustaining optimism around the science agenda in the midst of setbacks, of putting on the horizon what will it take for us to have a long-term sustainable approach that is balanced and fair-minded and adequately funded. So we owe him a great debt of gratitude, I believe, as a champion, as a person who has had such an imprint on people's lives, on governments, including our own, and on popular perceptions around the world about the nature of HIV/AIDS and what needs to happen. He will be, at the end of this year, stepping down from UNAIDS. He will be moving to Imperial College and London School of Economics, where he will be heading up a new Institute of Global Health. And we're very much looking forward to partnering with Peter and with his new institute. I think our agendas will actually be very complementary and very close. We've asked Peter this morning to do several things, and he's kindly agreed to do those. We've asked him really to step back and reflect on the last 12 years, because this was a turbulent period of great challenges and stresses and obstacles, of long stretches of time where sometimes it didn't seem like progress was possible, bursts of change that opened new horizons. So we're asking him to give us sort of his reflections on that, on the really remarkable last 12 years where he was really a witness to history and making history. We've asked him to look forward on the HIV/AIDS agenda with special reference to what we need to keep in mind as we think about the next several years, and we've asked him to really speak to the potential impact of the global financial crisis, both on the health status of vulnerable people living with HIV and others in the developing world, and the impacts on existing programs and investments that sustain lives and create the means for adequate prevention and care for many millions of people around the world. That's a lot, and so be patient. We've asked him to cover a lot of ground. I've asked him not to be too concerned. He'll really say what he can say on those big subjects, and when we're done, we'll move to a period where you will be given a chance to offer some comments and questions and interact with Peter. So please join me in welcoming him and thanking him for being with us.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you so much, Steve, for the kind introduction. And I should say congratulations with the creation of this Global Health Policy Forum. I think it will be another step in developing forward-looking policies for the U.S. and for other countries as well, which is badly needed. And I wish you good luck, and I really look forward to working with you in my new capacity. And when I look back, the CSIS Task Force on AIDS, or I don't remember the exact name, but what's it? Really, it was instrumental in generating America's leadership in the global response to AIDS, because that's what it has been, without any question. Now, you may wonder why I have come to Washington like a week before the elections, and some of the people around me said, you know, there won't be anybody at any speech, but you voted with your feet on that. It's, of course, not only important for the country, but also for the rest of the world, who is the president of the United States. That's always the case. And then also, why come here weeks into what is probably the most serious financial and perhaps also the most serious economic crisis since the 1930s. But as I'm approaching the end of my mandate at UNAIDS, I wanted to come for two reasons. First of all is to pay tribute to the U.S.'s effort in the global response to AIDS. This morning I was at the office of the Global AIDS Coordinator and PEPFAR and you know, and meet with the people, not only the ones in the countries, but also here, who have been so instrumental and without whose efforts, and of course the efforts of the administration and Congress and all of you here, to save literally millions of lives. It's quite rare in international development that you can count so easily, you can measure the impact of actions, and that this has been the case when it comes to what PEPFAR has done. And that it's unprecedented in international development. We sometimes forget that with all the struggles we have and about various aspects, and we all have our views on that, and that's fine. But when you take it to the bare essentials, it is an unprecedented program that has saved and is still saving millions of lives. And I've also come because as we struggle our way through the current financial maelstrom, this crisis, we need to find a way to ensure that not only well over 3 million people on antiretroviral therapy can remain alive for decades to come, but also that the millions who are not on treatment will have access and that we continue the prevention efforts on HIV. Interrupting that at this time or slowing down would be not only a disaster for millions of people, but also it would actually undermine the huge investments that have been made over the last few years and where the return on the investment is starting to come now only. And this is not the time to slow down efforts. But I'll talk about all this later on. This morning I'd like to reflect on where we are with the AIDS response, how it has been truly transformational for public health, for international development practice, and for multilateralism. What our challenges are for the near and the distant future. And I'll discuss all this through the lens of my 13 years of experience as executive director of UNAIDS, which has been quite an experience. Let's go back to the basics. Where were we in 1996 when UNAIDS became operational? A few facts, figures. $250 million were spent on the AIDS response in low and middle income countries. Trying to fix a global epidemic with that kind of money, that's just not possible, and yet that's what we were expected to do. Basically, no one in the developing world was on antiretroviral therapy, in, of course, not in 96, because then it came on the market, but 97, 98, even 99. There were only two countries in 96 that had experienced some decline of new infections as a result of their prevention efforts, and that's Uganda and Thailand. There were only three countries in the world where there was top leadership on AIDS, Uganda, Thailand, and Senegal. Only the ministries of health were involved in the fight against AIDS, no one else. There was basically no involvement of civil society, of groups of people living with HIV. There was not one country in the developing world, and most countries in the high-income countries, where harm reduction and injecting drug users was taken seriously, was active. And the UN system was in the most chaotic, dispersed order working on AIDS. So I could go on and on. And in one sentence, the response to AIDS was highly, highly inadequate. Today, there's a very different picture. I'm not pretending that that's all because of UNAIDS, but we've made a major role in this. On the downside, although I should say, when you look at the epidemic itself, today 33 million people are living with HIV. In 96, it was about 20 million. So there we've seen, unfortunately, major progress. 96, 900,000 people died from AIDS. Last year it was about 2 million, so that has gone up, and that's the result of the cumulative result of infections. But last year there were less new infections, 2.7 million, than in 96, when there were 3.2 million, even if there were less people living with HIV. So that's an indicator of also an impact, both of prevention programs, but also of some saturation in some populations. So the epidemic, there's no doubt, got much worse in the meantime, since 96. On the other hand, the response, this is where we see the biggest differences. $10 billion were spent last year on the AIDS response, so about 40 times more than 12 years ago. 3.5 million, probably close to 4 million people by the end of the year are on antiretroviral therapy in low and middle income countries. Unprecedented. A few years ago, that was still a couple of hundred thousand. In tens and tens of countries, there is a decline in new infections, particularly among young people. Some over 40 countries, we have a president or prime minister or deputy president leading the AIDS effort. Civil society is at the table. Look at the country coordinating mechanisms of the Global Fund. That's the most formal expression of that. China has now built about 500 clinics to distribute methadone and needle exchange and harm reduction. Who would have thought that? And the multilateral system is undoubtedly working much, much better together. This is actually quite a long list of progress, but most of that are means to get there. And this year, as every other year, as we do every other year, and initiated by Sally Cowell, who sits there when Sally was a deputy in UNAIDS, we issue a report on the state of the epidemic. For the first time since I'm in this job, it was a report that had some good news also. Before, it was only gloom and doom, and things get worse and so on and so on. You know, these kind of reports. And that's unfortunately also that's the only thing that has been picked up in the media. But this time there was some really good news, positive results. Less people dying, less people becoming infected. And that's what it's all about. The rest is process to get there. So I would say that there's really, let's call it, evidence-based hope. And that's the result of the investments of particularly the last 5-6 years. So how did we get there? When I got into this job, I had three goals. The first one was to put AIDS on the agenda, the political agendas in every country, globally, regionally, and so on. That was not at all the case. Secondly, was to build a brilliant alliance. I take the word from a book that is one of my favorite. It's by Adam Hochsmith, the one who wrote King Leopold's Ghost, very relevant for my country, for I come from Belgium, but who wrote a book on Bury the Chains, and it was about the movement for the abolition of slavery in the UK and in the late 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, using exactly the same political movement strategies as we do today, but instead of the internet, there were pigeons and horses to spread the news. And he calls that a brilliant alliance for the abolition of slavery. It was the Quakers who were the center, but then they even brought in the slave owners themselves. And I think that was my second goal, a brilliant alliance, break out of the straitjacket of AIDS doctors and AIDS activists, and bring in business, bring the development community, women's movement, religious groups, and bring it as a security issue, bring in the ministers of finance and so on. And the third goal was to mobilize the money, not for UNAIDS, as most organizations only mobilize for themselves. We mobilize a lot of money for others, for the countries who need it, for the communities who need it. So these were my objectives. And what I hadn't anticipated fully when we started with UNAIDS is that 6 months after our start, it was announced at an AIDS conference in Vancouver, at the International AIDS Conference, that there was something called then highly effective antiretroviral therapy. That's when you use three drugs, you can really treat somebody living with HIV and prevent people from dying and making sure you can have a normal life. That was a revolution in how we we looked at AIDS, which until then was a 100% quasi 100% fatal disease, and it profoundly changed the nature of the AIDS epidemic and how we respond to it. It was announced by David Ho. It was maybe a bit too optimistic, because then it was thought that this would be a cure, so that after X years, one could stop the treatment and the virus has disappeared from the body. Unfortunately, that turned out not to be true, and we still don't have a cure. But I spoke at the opening session of that opening ceremony of that conference, and I immediately expressed, one, my joy for this, but also my major concerns that the overwhelming majority of people living with HIV in the world, in the developing world, would be excluded from that revolution, and that we should work now and do everything we can to make sure that every single person in the world who needs it can have access to that treatment. But at that time, for example, American AIDS activists, and it was one of the first meetings I had when I was in this job, I came to Washington and had a meeting with AIDS activists here, and they bluntly told me, we are not interested in working with you, we are not interested in this international business. We have so many problems here, so basically, why don't you support us, but we don't need, don't count on us. The advantage was that, it was clear. Usually people say, I will do everything I can do to support you, and we will work together and then do nothing, but in this case, it was clear. So that didn't work very well in the beginning. And initially, there was, I would say, from 1996 to 2000, there was really very slow progress. But what we did in UNAIDS was building, to make the case, the evidence, collect and develop better data, building the organization in what was a quite hostile environment in the UN system. And it was around the Geneva AIDS Conference, one of the series we had, the last one was in Mexico. I realized that we were going nowhere. We were not going anywhere with a classic public health approach, with a fairly academic approach based on the fact that if you have the evidence, the rest will follow. I mean, I have an academic background, so I was pretty naive from that perspective. I know today that evidence is a minor element in decision making, be it personal decision making or policy decision making. But on the other hand, of course, we need to make sure that when decisions are made, that they're based on the best possible evidence. So we were not going anywhere, no progress. So I called a retreat, and with some friends and others, and not from the usual eight suspects, and we basically came up with a political strategy, but always grounded in science. And a political strategy that says we're going to bring the AIDS issue where nobody expects it, and where the power is. And the power is, at the end of the day, is in the economy and in security. And if there's money left over, it's going to be money for social issues and so on. And so the economy, Sally and I went to the World Economic Forum, and President Nelson Mandela gave a speech there, and so we tried to work on the business community, the economic sector. We documented the tremendous economic impact of AIDS, particularly in Southern Africa. A breakthrough was that when in January 2000, then Vice President Al Gore chaired a special session of the UN Security Council, a special session devoted to AIDS. And people say, why would you even discuss AIDS in that, at the Security Council where they talk about war and peace and that's it? And that's because we could convince that there are other definitions of security than just the absence of war and so on. And Ambassador Holbrooke really was very instrumental in setting up that meeting. We also had that year the African ministers of finance who had a meeting, and I went there. Because our approach was one of infiltration and basically guerrilla tactics, because if you're not welcome, you have to put your foot in the door and then just bring your case. They addressed AIDS, and they were far more open to it than the ministers of health, because one of my biggest problems were the ministers of health, particularly in Southern Africa and in Eastern Africa, who didn't want to hear about AIDS. And it was led by just until a few months ago, the Minister of Health of South Africa, and rallying, her colleagues, and in a quasi-denialist movement. But the Minister of Finance, they were far more open. Many of them were personally affected in their family, but they also started thinking about the budgetary implications, both loss of income and increase in expenditure for healthcare and so on. And then 2001 was really, retrospectively, was a turning point. We had a stellar start with the then called the Organization of African Unity, presided then over by President Obasanjo from Nigeria, who called a summit in Abuja, and basically all his colleagues, nearly all presidents of Africa were there. And that really broke the silence around AIDS in Africa. When the top leaders in the country, this was in April 2001, were saying, we're going to lead the charge here. We're going to lead the effort against AIDS. It is threatening the development of our continent. And that included also presidents from countries, particularly from West Africa, that were, after all, very little affected. And since I'm in Washington, D.C., I should remind all of us here that Washington, D.C. has a higher HIV prevalence rate than many West African countries. That was a breakthrough. And Kofi Annan was there, and he made his call for what he called a war chest, a fight against AIDS. Because without money, we can't do it, of course. And then a few months later, there was a special session of the UN General Assembly devoted to AIDS. First time ever that the General Assembly devoted an entire session to a health issue. It was 3 days. I thought it was a lot of talk when I was in there. I'm Flemish and I'm educated, and speaking is silver, silence is gold, and so on. And here people talk. But there were over 40... heads of state, heads of government. And most of them went home and they said, now I'm in charge. Big difference when the president, whether it's the president or the minister of health, because that's in terms of the power that that gives, the budgets that are being voted, various sectors being involved. And it is at that special session of the UN General Assembly, UNGAS for those who like acronyms, was a turning point also because it led to the creation of the Global Fund, which became operational already 2002 in a speed time. And it coincided and it helped also a reduction in the price of antiretroviral drugs. Because we had been working with UNAIDS already in 1998. We had started with two programs to provide antiretroviral therapy in Africa, one in Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire, and one in Kampala, in Uganda. And that was it was not an NGO. It was not Médecins Sans Frontières or some activists that started. It was UNAIDS that started with the first programs to provide antiretroviral therapy, the Drug Access Initiative. And the way I could sell this to my board, where all the donors were against that, was that we should study this in a pilot, and you know how these things go when you start. And it was true. We didn't know how to do this in a totally resource-poor environment. And but then the price was still too high, and it came down slowly. But it was thanks to some particularly contacts at the World Economic Forum, direct contacts with CEOs of pharmaceutical companies, that we could negotiate an over 90% reduction in the price of antiretrovirals. Without that, it would have been very difficult for taxpayers' money to come up with huge treatment programs. And the Global Fund was necessary from my perspective before it existed, because I was convinced that we needed so-called ring-fenced funding, protected funding, to offer antiretroviral therapy. And the compromise was also that it would also provide programs, support for tuberculosis and for malaria. This was necessary because otherwise countries like Japan were not willing to deal with AIDS only. And that's fine with me. I mean, I think these are, when you look at it, the Global Fund is a quasi-monopoly in providing support for TB programs in developing countries, and is the number one funder by, I think, 70% for malaria programs in the world. So here you see a first huge collateral benefit of the AIDS movement was for TB and malaria programs. And it was a bit hard for us to cope with the fact that this was a multilateral body put outside the UN system, because it was felt, and I agree with that, I was representing the Secretary General Kofi Annan in the negotiations, to have a very efficient mechanism to put money behind programs. But the Global Fund is only a financial mechanism. It is not into policy making, it's not into technical support and so on. And then in January 2003, President Bush made his historic State of the Union speech, historic from the AIDS perspective, where he asked for $15 billion from Congress to start what is now known as PEPFAR. And of course, the Global Fund doesn't print money, so its major contributor is the U.S. government. And the people sometimes forget that. It's not that these are totally independent things. You know, the Global Fund here is funding that, and then PEPFAR there, and bilateral programs from the U.K. and what have you. No, it's all very much linked. This is an example of how we are globalized as a world. And that made a real difference. And the rest you know. I'd like to mention three what was considered as insurmountable barriers. The first one was to what I called when I gave a talk in Durban at the AIDS conference in 2000. I said, we need to move from the M word to the B word, from millions to billions. What had happened since the foundation of UNAIDS was that every year was a bit more money coming up. But we were still struggling. We were happy, 10 millions more here. And when there was 100 million more, we said, wonder, oh, this is a great breakthrough. But I said, you know, you need to get to a threshold, and as long as you're under that, you won't make it. And that threshold word starts with a B, not with an M, billions. And And that was people who were in classic development. They said, just forget it. This is not going to happen. I even have a letter that I got from co-signed by senior officials, let's call it, from USAID and DFID, and saying, one, I should not make this kind of irresponsible statements, that, you know, the money is not there, and in any case, the funding for AIDS will go down over the next few years. This is in the end of 99. Of course, I knew a bit better than what they didn't know, which was we were doing our guerrilla operation in the... and so getting to that level seemed insurmountable, and yet it happened. And it happened, you know, after 2001. And this is where the, you know, President Bush's State of the Union was kind of the shot in the arm, if I may use that term. Secondly, was about the price of antiretrovirals. Seemed insurmountable for many reasons. Pharmaceutical industry said, you know, okay, we're used to economies of scale, so you can, you know, get lower prices and so on. But again, we're talking about 10% less, 15% less, 20% less, 25%. But for a public health program in low-income countries, you know, even if you get 60% price reduction from something that costs $14,000, we're still talking about, what, you know, $6,000, $7,000, $5,000. That's too much. You need to get through a few hundreds. And we are now today the cheapest combination therapy that you can get. First-line therapy that the Global Fund is buying is like around $85 per person per year. We're coming from about $14,000. Just and it's the same drugs. It is not some surrogate, you know, drug. It's exactly the same products. Sometimes even produced by exactly the same manufacturer. Sometimes by somebody else, by a generic manufacturer. But getting that price down was really tough. Here, Kofi Annan was instrumental. Also, we had several meetings of. CEOs, always accompanied by antitrust lawyers and others, which we don't have in UNAIDS. We don't have one. we're really... it was really through the personal involvement and engagement of the CEOs that we got these breakthroughs. Because we had endless meetings getting through the system where always there was, we understand, but forget it, this is not possible, and our board won't agree, and this, and then all kinds of legal, objections. But basically what we made was the following deal. The following deal was that with the pharmaceutical industry is that in return for intellectual property protection, which gives you a monopoly for X years, and good profits in high-income markets, you make these drugs available at cost plus. We never asked to give money or to give the drugs for free to low-income markets. And that deal is still functioning. And in the meantime, because they were not operational yet, in the meantime, generic manufacturers came in, introducing some generic competition, and we also were involved in brokering an international legal arrangement in Doha around the so-called TRIPS, trade-related intellectual property agreements. So all that really produced something that is unprecedented, this price reduction. And a third insurmountable barrier that I'd like to mention, and there are many, is that what I mentioned before is that who would have thought that even 3 years ago that China would go resolutely for needle exchange and for methadone and so on, for, in other words, for harm reduction in among injecting drug users. It's there are many countries where that's still not possible, not only in the developing world. And it is an example of a policy barrier that could be overcome in ways by very smart, I think, political action. And in all these elements, UNAIDS played a key role. It's during this 10 years, I would say, the first 10 years, that the AIDS response also became transformational for how we look at public health and practice public health, or should do it, I think, international development and multilateralism. And let me give you what I see as five features of this transformational nature. The first one is that our approach from day one has been a rights-based approach. In other words, just to take the example of when treatment becomes available, we said, you know, nobody who needs this kind of treatment, wherever in the world, whether how poor they may be, should be denied access to this kind of life-saving treatment. That's a right. How to do that, that's another matter. But that's a very different approach than when what's usually done in international development agencies or organizations or international financial institutions, where it's cost containment. That is the, you know, that's basically the philosophy. They say, we have this amount of money, and now we're going to see what we can do with that. And we said we don't accept that framework, because that's not just how you should look at it. What we have to do is then, if we need more money, we should increase the pot of money and fight for that. So a rights-based approach, not only in terms of the protection of human rights of individuals who are affected by HIV and so on, but also in the fundamental approach was very different from what was used until then in public health and all that. Secondly, I would say, is a total focus on results for people. And both are important, results and people, not on systems processes. If you're only focusing on results, you may forget about the people and you just tick off the box for which indicator you've achieved. If you only focus on the people, you may actually forget that you need to have results. And so this is introduced a new culture of public accountability, and I think PEPFAR is a good example of that. Sometimes maybe in general, in development, we have too much of one or the other. Thirdly is that the AIDS response has been truly multidisciplinary, genuinely bring together various disciplines, various sectors, beyond tokenism. Now, that's not easy. I wasn't born as a multidisciplinary person, and I wasn't trained as a multidisciplinary person. And very few people are. And yet, in today's world, to solve the problems in our globalized world, you can't solve any of them through one discipline or one sector. The illusion that you can provide better health by only having a medical approach is still deeply embedded in the public health community, certainly in the medical community. But it's an illusion. It's not working. It has maybe never worked, but it's certainly not going to work. So that's why we went for this multi-sectoral approach and a more structural approach. And we still have a long way to go, but I think that's it's a transformational aspect of the AIDS movement. Fourth is that the AIDS response is very inclusive. And nothing without the people who are concerned is a key role for those who are affected, a key role for vulnerable populations, a key role for ownership, because we know that it doesn't work. No business would start launching a new product without talking to its potential customers to scan the environment. We don't do that. Traditionally, we don't do that. We say that's too expensive, we waste our time, let's go for it, and we have the message and we try to pump the message through and so on. That doesn't work. We have enough evidence for that. And while we have been working so much with these affected communities, why was that? In the beginning, also because governments didn't want to deal with it, so we had to go around it. But then it became really part of the response. And it has also been, I think, a very important instrument for promoting democracy. I was in Ukraine last week, and it's clear there that, for example, the All-Ukrainian Network of People with HIV has thousands and thousands of members. It's a very strong democracy-oriented movement, which was not their intention, but they were fighting for their survival. We see it in South Africa with TAC. There's so many examples. In China, there is space for civil society on two areas, in the environment and on AIDS. I mean, it is limited, but there is some space. So this is a very important element also that we have. And fifth, transformational nature is that AIDS is a problem, a phenomenon of our globalized world, and it requires a truly global response. And even if there are bilateral programs like PEPFAR, and there's a global fund and so on, but when you think of it, how we work together in countries, how the policies are related and so on, it also illustrates how that's global. And we cannot have a response that is only embedded in one country or one organization. It's just not possible. So this is really, I think, also probably for the first time that we, since acute eradication efforts like we are not there yet. There is still smallpox eradication. But that was a small beer, as we say in Flemish, you know, as compared to what we have to do now, eradicating smallpox. But it worked because it was a global effort. So that is also, I think, preempting the fact that we, in international development, we will have to go far more through networks of global coordination. And Bob Zelig, the president of the World Bank, gave a very interesting talk at the Peterson Institute for International Economics here in Washington, I think in September, I can't remember when it was, on what he calls new type of multilateralism. And he made a case, he said, the time is gone for very hierarchical type of multilateralism. The future is for networks. It's networks, and that's exactly what UNAIDS has been about. That's why it's also sometimes hard to understand, particularly for people who like to know exactly who reports to who and who see only the organigram, the boxes. But it's through the networks that we really make this impact. Again, I would say that in terms of the this approach, this transformational approach, is basically, at the end of the day, fundamentally good development and good business practice, nothing more than that. Let me turn to the challenges, and there are some old ones and some new ones. The old ones is one of, the first one is maintaining AIDS on the agenda. It's never been easy. People who tell me, oh, you know, how are you going to do this? And so I said, well, you know, forget when it was not at all on the agenda, we also had to fight with it. But now it's a different type of effort. To maintain something is not always as easy as and certainly less sexy than to bring it on. It will require new alliances, I think, new positioning of AIDS, a new political strategy. And I think our best argument is actually that there are results. Results unprecedented in development. And that's too rare. I mean, it's a good investment to start with. And we can discuss what the other elements are saying. So the first one is that. The second one is that we need more of the same. Sounds very boring, but we need more of the same. I was in September at the Clinton Global Initiative, and my brief from the Clinton Global Initiative said that I had to be innovative, new ideas, never said before. I mean, you know, this kind of things. And I said, well, I'm going to come with a very, very new idea. We need more of the same. It's very boring, but it's true. When you look at the fact that how many people have not been reached yet with prevention programs, with treatment and so on, I mean, it doesn't mean that it has to be done the same way, but we need more of the same. But this so-called scaling up, as we like to say in public health, doesn't necessarily mean more mega programs. It may mean more boutiques and franchising and so on to reach more people. And that's something where we need to have a serious discussion in what kind of models are the best ones to deliver what. And clearly we need to go far more to, I would say, to customization of what we are doing. The epidemic and the response are now so diversified, so different from one place to another, that one approach to the problem in any country all over the world can't work. So we need more pluralism on that also, particularly on the how. Third challenge, the old challenge that I see is to implement sound science-informed policies. This is one of the more frustrating parts of when you work in AIDS, that I find myself in exactly the same discussions as 10 years ago or even 15 years ago. I mentioned harm reduction. That's one. But there are others in terms of, what works in prevention. And here, prevention specialists are probably the worst enemies of it because they spend their time fighting with each other about whether, it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that, that you should have. And with the absurd search for the single thing that's going to work, let's come to terms with complexity, please. This is about one of the most complex issues in human behavior and in our lives, sexuality. And then we're going to solve that by cutting penises or by saying we need to stick to this or that and abstinence only or whatever. No, I mean, it just won't work. We need a far more complex approach that is corresponding to people's lives and the reality of that. So we still have a long way to go. And that may mean also that in many countries, like homosexuality is against the law. Now, we see new epidemics of men who have sex with men in all over Asia. Every single city in Asia, in China, in Malaysia, Indonesia, we've looked at this, an epidemic of HIV among men who have sex with men that reminds me of the early 80s in the West. And it's really, every year you look at it, it's shooting up in a tremendous way. In some countries, homosexuality is even not discussable. It's taboo. Some countries, people are hanged. And we have the Caribbean, just down here, where the old Victorian laws from the inheritance of British colonial times make it illegal. So how can you deal with it? So we need to tackle these structural issues in a far more direct way before. Fourth old challenge is what we call in UNAIDS making the money work for people. All this money, I think, can be spent better, probably. We've come a long way, and we've been learning alongside. And we didn't really know how to bring chronic treatment in resource-poor environments. We didn't know that, so we had to do everything we could. I think now is the time for both treatment and also for prevention to think about efficiency. Where are efficiency gains? And we need to bring in the professionals of branding, the professionals of marketing, of management. I mean, there's a great project in India, Avahan, supported by the Gates Foundation, and they're working with hard-to-reach populations. For men who sex with men, sex workers, truck drivers, and so on. It's run by all kind of business people with a business background and a very different approach. But at the same time, they're less technocratic than the public health people. I find it really interesting because they have the reflex, okay, we're going to talk and sit down with the people we work with because we want to have results. So we need to do that far more in what we are doing. And for UNAIDS, that means, as our biggest challenge for the future, is the relationship with the Global Fund. It's not the one with WHO and so on, as some people say. That's a 20th century problem. The 21st century challenge for UNAIDS is the relationship with the Global Fund. For the best multilateral approach to AIDS, it's the synergy between the two that really is going to make a difference. And there we have great progress. In terms of the old challenges, one that I mentioned just because it's important to not forget it, is that continuing efforts on R&D, research and development, the vaccines, microbicides, it's important to mention it because there have been so many disappointments recently that we should make sure don't give up. In terms of the new challenges, very quickly, the number one is sustainability. Most obvious in terms of people on treatment. We want people to be alive 10, 20, 30 years from now. How to do that? Who's going to pay for that? Will they continue taking the treatment? Will there be new drugs available when there's resistance and so on? But it's also true for prevention. In Uganda, for example, there is an increase in new infections. Thailand has seen an increase in new infections. These were the first countries to be successful. All over Western Europe, we see an increase in new infections in the gay community. So sustainability. Secondly, is a link with development issues, link with sexual and reproductive health, link with TB programs, linkages with food programs. I mean, when I go around, in particularly in Africa, and when I look at what are the biggest problems now for sustainable treatment, it's not the drugs that are there. Supply chain management is getting better and better. That's another example of how we've learned. It's getting there, but people have no food. People have no money to pay to take the bus to go to the clinic and so on. So we need to have these linkages with development and programs. Thirdly is also incorporate a long-term view. The quarterly report doesn't work for something like AIDS, if it works for anything. This means boosting prevention efforts, addressing, finally, vulnerabilities around gender and so on, and invest more in local capacity. Not only health services, but also social services and community resilience. This is what AIDS 2031 is about. It's a project, that initiative that I took, and it's trying to understand what to do now to affect the future, to envisage a world without AIDS. It's not what we should do in 2031, but it's what we should do now to have a better outcome later on. We are not going to win this with only an emergency response. What we need is also a long-term response. And there is then the financial and economic crisis. First, let's not forget that for billions of people, there was a crisis before the crisis. They were living on $1 or less than $2 a day. So let's not forget that for a minute. Two, since I guess Adam Smith and so on, we know that the economy affects everything. And so we should be very, very clear about that. And third, probably we won't see any impact as far as the AIDS response is concerned in the next 6 or 12 months because of commitments that have been made in better times. And, for example, for the Global Fund beneficiaries, the major risk will be for contracts that are ending next year and that have to be renewed for another 5 years. Will the money be there? So what's the impact? First, on funding. Official development history, assistance, lessons from history. The CGD issued some paper where it was analyzing what happened in countries, in donor countries that went through some major crisis. 1990, Japan, ODA went down by 44% and still has not recovered. 91, Sweden, Norway, and Finland went through a major banking crisis. Swedish ODA went down by 17% and Finland by 60%. Sweden recovered in 6 to 9 years. Finland still not recovered. So in all likelihood, there will be an impact. Foreign direct investments are already going down. Remittances, which is twice ODA, may go down. And state budgets will go down. And we have also now something new, and that's emerging countries are also affected by this crisis. To what extent is not so clear. And there may be an impact on the spread of HIV with increasing poverty. 100 million people, that was a result earlier on, as a result of increasing food prices, energy crisis and so on, had been pushed into poverty. That must have an impact on the spread of HIV. Although it's not so clear, I'm not willing to make some strong statements if we don't have the evidence. But the impact on the response is really very worrisome. I'm very worried about, particularly the most obvious one, is impact on treatment programs. I here have a list of dependency of countries for treatment of their citizens with HIV. Rwanda, about 50,000 people are on antiretroviral therapy. That was at the end of last year. 100% is paid by donor money. It's PEPFAR, Global Fund, and a few others. It's true for other countries as well, but less for others. Like Botswana, close to 100,000 people on treatment, only 30% is paid for by donors. South Africa, now 430,000 people on treatment, 21% by donors. Brazil, zero paid for by donors. So we have particularly the low-income countries, the least developed countries that are going to be more affected and more vulnerable to this for treatment. You can ask a question that I've asked here many times in Washington. You can wonder, what is the notion of sovereignty for a country for the survival of the citizens? This is dependent on a vote in a parliament somewhere. This is quite a fundamental political issue. And so that's a big issue. Will we be able to continue enrolling 700,000 to 1 million people in antiretroviral therapy over the next few years, which has been the case of the last few years? If not, deaths will go up again, deaths from AIDS, no doubt about it. We estimate if it continues just even at the same level, deaths will go up to about 3 million per year by 2011. But we also have issues around sustainability, impoverishment. People may not see that as a priority anymore because they need to work, food security, and so on. So here the key will be to make sure that, on the one hand, there is no decrease in the funding, but also, again, that we can become more efficient. But prevention, I'm actually most worried about, because politically that's where the first cuts may be taken. And at the current level of expenditure, the number of new infections will go up already. However, if the same level of money is reallocated to the most effective interventions, I think we can still avert quite a number of infections. So I think here the key is to become more efficient as much as preserving the gains. And then something that I don't hear about much about, but it's support to orphans, also risks to go down tremendously in times of economic crisis. What we need to do there is making sure that to continue to make the case, new alliances for the money, stress that there's real return on investment, and that cutting budgets now would also mean that the efforts, the investments, the development of the supply chains and all that, these investments will have been useless and will be a huge loss of money that was being invested before. And we have to become more efficient. And it was really heartening to hear President Bush and Secretary Rice, was it last week, at the Summit on Development, to make a plea for continuing American leadership here, and I hope that the next president will follow, that along the same line. So to conclude, a few lessons, as Steve asked me to do that. When looking back at this time, my time at UNAIDS are many, many, and I may have quite a different list a year from now, so because now I'm too close to everything. But the overall and main lesson for me is that we can move mountains. We can move mountains if all the stars are aligned, if we have a determined worldwide coalition of individuals and organizations with clear targets and a clear strategy, we can make it. And that we allow the space for diversity, for pluralism. We hear often people saying, oh, the health sector and the global health is so divided and all that, but frankly there's also a richness of multiple actors, as long as they talk and as long as we move along, for the same objectives. And as long as we have the strategy and targets. I visited the Olympics in September and the Paralympics in Beijing, and I saw a huge poster. It was an ad for Adidas, and it said, impossible is nothing, which made me think. First I thought I was jet-lagged, and I had, but it's a very powerful slogan, and I think impossible is nothing is really what it's that's what we've demonstrated. It's not, nothing is impossible if it is there. And let me analyze a few things on that of the lessons. First of all, you really need an alliance which has to be diverse and global. And I think that South Africa, for example, who would have thought what could bring together the Communist Party, the Chamber of Mines, the Anglican Church, the trade union, COSATU, and people living with HIV in one coalition? I mean, that's AIDS. Unlikely coalition, but it works. If you say this is this is an emergency, this is about survival, we agree now that we want to achieve 1, 2, 3, and that's it. And everybody who agrees with that and with certain values to do with human rights and so on, we're part of the movement and we go for it. That is really important, this alliance. And I think we saw the same thing here in the U.S. The bipartisan support, the involvement of people who don't agree on most things, but on AIDS it is. And that's important to keep that glue and to keep that together. If that's falling apart, I think we will see a total decline of our efforts. And that's what I think has been the secret of the successful American leadership on AIDS, this broad base. Secondly, is that we need to stick to both science and rights. If it's just science, then we go into a very technocratic approach. If it's only the rights, we may forget about science. Don't give in on either. Third lesson is that never wait until systems are fixed. Be impatient. Go for it. If we would have waited until health systems, health services would be functioning very well before starting with antiretroviral therapy, which was the conventional wisdom of every single donor, I know what would have happened with the 3-4 million people who are on antiretroviral therapy today. They would be in the grave. They would be dead. It's as simple as that. And in the meantime, by introducing therapy, the systems are being strengthened and being built, and not the other way around. People who are accusing the AIDS movement are saying, you're undermining health system. That doesn't even pass the laugh test. It doesn't pass the laugh test. Every research that is being done is either it's neutral or there have been strengthening of the systems. But of course, much more has to be done. Fourth lesson for me is that good politics can save lives, bad politics kill people. Published an article last year in the American Journal of Public Health with that as a title. And it is so striking that good politics, meaning speaking out about difficult issues, be it condoms or harm reduction or gender violence, and they're going to save lives. They make it possible to do programs. If bad politics is the denial, it's making sure that science-based approaches can't take hold. Fifth is that we need to take a long-term view. Don't give up. If we would have said, okay, it doesn't work after a couple of years, then again, we would not have the results today. And now we need to take that longer-term view also in what we do. And last point is that what I said before, come to terms with complexity of this epidemic, because it's about people. And also development is complex. And so we have to continue to learn and radically reject any attempt and any claims of people who say that they have the solution. If only you would do that, Dr. Piot, this epidemic would stop. I mean, I get letters like that. There are even people who write books and publish books and make a living by propagating this kind of ideas. And it just doesn't work because it's about people and societies. So that's it, and there are many more. At the end of the day, is what matters most is that we sustain the efforts, we continue to save lives, we put people first, and I call on you to never give up. We should never give up. And America's leadership on this is absolutely vital, because it has been vital up to now, and it must continue. That's what I expect from the next president and the next administration, because it means so clearly the difference between life and death. And as we are entering also the final phase of the selection of my successor, that's in the hands of the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon now, I'm also asking you to support my successor just as you've supported me, whoever it may be. It's been a real privilege to serve in my capacity as executive director. I've learned a lot, and I've become a greater optimist, a greater believer in people, and a greater believer that we can move mountains. So thank you so much for...
Thank you, Peter, for such an eloquent and comprehensive statement. We do live in an age in which individual leaders matter enormously in shaping approaches on global health, and I think, Peter, you're the lead example for that. I was a little negligent earlier in not acknowledging the help we received from John Hassell from the UNAIDS office And Karen Meacham, my colleague here at CSIS, in putting this program together, and I just want to thank both of them. We're open to take quick comments and questions. We're going to take several in a bundle and then come back to Peter. So put your hand up, and we have microphones down here in the front. Please identify yourself. Please be very succinct. Go here, and then we'll go to this gentleman in the front row. We'll take a series of four comments and questions. Yes, sir.
Yeah, just thank you very much for your words and for all your service. David Bryden with Global AIDS Alliance. Wanted to get your sense. How do we respond to two really severe challenges? One is that for every person there is in the U.S. devoted to expanding the overall amount of money available for foreign assistance, whether that's health or others, we have another 100 people interested in fighting with each other about how to divide that up.
Yes.
And the other challenge is, when we look at that evidence-based, rights-based approach that you talked about, how do we confront the severe challenge of people who are opposed to full integration, for instance, of family planning services with HIV-AIDS services, and who are opposed to women who are HIV-positive having easy, ready access to family planning, even when they're taking antiretrovirals that may cause birth defects? So a severe challenge as we go forward. I want to know how we could confront that.
We have two gentlemen right here. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. I'm David Shearer, chairman of the board of the Jane Goodall Institute. First of all, I just want to congratulate you on what I think is an absolutely brilliant statement, a series of statements. My only comment is, I think you give us inspiration for looking at the relationship of people to environmental sustainability, which is what my organization is all about. And the internationalization of that is also, I think, an extraordinarily important set of linkages. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Just next to you.
Wonderful talk. Thank you very much for your remarks. Rick Berzon with the Foundation for AIDS Research. Just a quick question. A recent study indicates that early treatment boosts survival. This was data from the developing world, U.S. and Canada. And I'm wondering the outcomes, the implications for this kind of information. Has a lot to do with people getting tested and willing to learn their status. In the developing world, can you just comment on this and how it might play out there? Thank you.
Let's take one more question comment over here, please.
Anne Lyon, and thank you very much, Dr. Piot. It does continue to give us hope, and we look forward to remaining partners with you in your next chapter. I'm Anne Lyon with I'm project director of the Health Systems 2020 project. And you mentioned sustainability as one of our key challenges and opportunities, and that's going to be a huge effort as we go forward through the next decades. But as part of the complexity of sustainability, the issue of leadership and management at the country level and at the programmatic level is one that is of huge concern. As we look at the Global Fund grants, over a third of them right now are having performance issues. And we've made major progress in procurement supply chain management and other areas within the management system, but the overall management of programs is one that is a very large concern, and I don't see either the Global Fund or the PEPFAR reauthorization addressing management and leadership component of the programs.
Thank you. Peter, why don't we come back to you?
Yeah.
Now we've got four big issues on the table.
Briefly, and I'm sorry, I didn't realize I spoke for so long. But there's no question in my mind that the pie has to get bigger. And I think that's where we're on the right trajectory. And I think that even in economic and financially hard times, It's a good use of taxpayers' money for the U.S., the image of the world. If today, the goodwill that PEPFAR has bought or is buying for the image of the U.S., to put that into dollar terms, that's enormous. And, I mean, that's one aspect of it, but it is really part of a, I would argue, a fundamental part of foreign policy, but also important for doing other things in the world at goodwill. Now, how to avoid the fights and all that you alert to, that's really something not for me to address here in the U.S., but I think making sure that there are alliances. Of course, some people, depending on how the elections will turn out, but some people will feel that their issue was neglected and so there's no time, payback time or whatever. The worst case scenario would be if this would become a free-for-all and everybody's grabbing for the money. And I'm not privy enough to what kind of discussions there are, what kind of alliances and so on, but it is clear that we have to look also at some of the systemic issues. I mean, what you mentioned, if we can invest also like on the health side, health workforce and management and all that, that's something that will benefit many issues. But there is a tradition in this country because of the budgetary allocation process, which is absolutely unique in the world, that there are allocations for very specific bits and pieces. In Europe, you don't have that. I know more members of Congress in the U.S. than in my own country, and we only are 10 million people in my country, though we probably have as many in Parliament. But anyway, that's a different issue. My recommendation would be really to be far more strategic and not to, to kill each other in the process of the advocacy. And see, and there are issues that have been neglected. But it's difficult to say that what is more important, a woman who dies while giving birth, than somebody dying from AIDS. I mean, that's not a choice we want to make. And it is a scandal that there are 500,000 women dying every year in childbirth, giving, or how do you say that in English? On the evidence, the rights-based, again, that's about my point about politics, good politics, bad politics. And I think there, though, what we have tried to do as UNAIDS, and particularly using the so-called three ones, where various donors come together in a given country and then see who can do what. I mean, every donor has constraints. There are different constraints. Some are more ideological constraints, and others are process constraints or bureaucratic ones, or some donors only want to give budget support, or they can't fund. Some donors cannot fund NGOs, only through the government. Others can only go through non-governmental organizations. So what do? We bring them together and see, okay, this is what a country needs according to what the country feels are its objectives, and then we see who can contribute to what. But that can only work really in countries with a strong state government. I mean, I'm not talking about dictatorial type of state, but where there is an administration and where there is leadership, both political leadership and technical leadership. And then you can bring it together. This is what I know that Minister Tedros was here last week. And when you see how he and his team, how they negotiate with donors so that at the end of the day, the money is used for what the Ethiopian government wants to do. I mean, you can argue there may be more need for more space for civil society and so on, definitely. But it is very different from some other countries where a donor comes in the country and does whatever they want to do. And that's often less the case with big donor agencies, but small NGOs and so on. I mean, that can create enormous problems. And so I think from our perspective, from UNAIDS, we've tended to work at a partner country level, because there's no way that we can influence or are allowed or we should even influence what decision that U.S. Congress takes. So I would say go for that, but it makes perfect sense, of course, that sexual reproductive health, it's not the same thing as dealing with AIDS, but that there is a very strong linkage. There's no doubt about that. Other David, on the environment, yes, indeed. I mean, we are... there are other comparisons. When you take climate change, we used to think in terms of, as climatologists, in 10,000 years or maybe or something like that.
today that is from a long wave event has become an acute crisis. And AIDS is a bit going the other way around. I mean, we still tend to think only of the crisis and not the fact that this is a long wave event. But also we can learn from the environmental approaches and movement in many aspects, sustainability, but also risk analysis and risk management, which is embedded in the environmental sciences. So well taken. On the treatment, the need for starting treatment earlier. Yeah, we've been discussing that, and we already, with WHO, who's in the lead for our, in UNAIDS, for the medical aspects in our joint UN system, we've already said, put the bar at like, is it 350 34 per cubic millimeter to initiate treatment. But even that may not be, you know, good enough. So it has huge implications when we make that kind of recommendations. The cost implications are, you know, you see a doubling of the need for treatment and so on. That's not a reason not to make the recommendation, but we need to take that into account. And then, of course, as you say, the need for promoting further testing. I think there also we've made some progress, but not yet where we have. It's very country-dependent. And a major factor is stigma, discrimination, and people don't feel that they are not going to, I mean, that they're going to be, that they're protected, their rights, and that they're not going to be kicked out of the house or their job, then it's a hard sell, and I understand that fully. So it has to go hand in hand with protection of the rights of the, where we often, again, when you take classic medical approach, to think, okay, we take your arm, take the blood, and test, and that's it, and my responsibility as a doctor ends here. I think that's pretty irresponsible. It has to be part of a package. Sustainability issues. I couldn't agree more, I think, on the leadership and, you know, it's management, but it's leadership at several levels. I think we in UNAIDS, we may have, and myself personally, have put too much emphasis on the political leadership, but there's also technical leadership. Take prevention, HIV prevention. We suffer of a dramatic lack of technical leadership. We have lots of academics writing articles, but that's not very useful in a country. It's very important to continue the research. There's no doubt about that. And on the management side, one problem is that people in charge of these programs, they change every 6 months in some countries, just to take it to the very basics. But it's the management in public sector in most countries, not only developing countries, is usually pretty weak. So we, rather than to as a saying, okay, that grant is not performing, and say then we should stop funding, I think that's a very wrong approach to development. We should then see, okay, for the next grant or the next phase, X percent must be invested into improving the management and the system. But how to do that in either government bureaucracy or in a country where people are badly paid, where there is not that culture, where there are no incentives, that's a huge challenge. And again, I think here the AIDS response could be a pioneer for other development programs, because we're all struggling with the same thing. Whether you work on education, on water, on better governance and so on, a lot comes down to management. And I think also the schools of public health in this country and elsewhere, maybe students should be far more trained in management than in epidemiology.
We're getting late. Let's take two, maybe three more questions. Sally, down front here, and then in the rear, and then Janet. Please identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Sally Cole with PSI, and Peter, as usual, thank you for your inspiring words and a trip down memory lane. I remember when I came to work at UNAIDS in 1995, totally a non-scientist, I asked you whether I would have time to get there before they developed the vaccine. And you said, well, you're going to be here in a couple of months, I think that's probably. You'll probably have some room to work. You didn't say much about a vaccine, although you encouraged us to keep up efforts on R&D. But how do you look at the vaccine question now at the end of your tenure?
Thank you. There's a hand in the back.
Dr. Piot, thank you again for your many years of strong leadership and service. Jean Duff, Center for Interfaith Action on Global Poverty. Would you speak to the question of continuing opportunity for the engagement of the faith community in the fight against HIV/AIDS?
Thank you. Janet Fleischman?
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Piot, very much for all the work for all these years and hopefully going forward in your new center. I wanted to raise the issue. I'm with the Global Health Policy Center of CSIS, and I wanted to raise a little bit more the issue of gender. We know that there are gender policies in place now at PEPFAR, at the Global Fund, at the World Bank. There's sort of a moment of greater attention to these issues and yet not the kind of action we'd like to see. What recommendations do you have for your successor on how to move this issue?
Okay. I think that's
Sally, on the vaccine reflection, we've been looking for the home run and only for that. So the trials that have been held were designed to, in the first place, to demonstrate it works or it doesn't work. And that means we haven't really learned enough. One of the things I'm going to do is I'm chairing the board of the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise, which brings together from NIH to IAVI to companies and so on to better joint efforts. There has not been good, I was going to say coordination, sounds so bureaucratic, but it is that, and sharing of data and so on, vaccine development. And the stage we're at now is that we have to go back to the drawing board. That's kind of the consensus now. And learn from that and bring in new blood also. It's people of my age that also work on the... I mean, I know them all, and that's it's not a good sign. So there are... It's new blood, fresh blood. That's what we need, new investigators, people who come from other fields and how to do that. And that's what we're trying to do with the Vaccine Enterprise, which is... an initiative that was taken by the Gates Foundation several years ago. So I think for all practical purposes, let's not count on it for the foreseeable future, as long as we in our budget cycles and all that. Gene, on the faith community, yeah, definitely. I mean, when I said broaden the alliance and so on, that was definitely part of it. And I, again, just going back to where I was in last week in Ukraine, I had a meeting with. Various people, you know, the groups refuse to use the word faith-based. It's interesting. It's religious. I can't remember what it was, but something religious. And I think there also we need at the same time space for everybody, but also a very clear program and with some do's and don'ts. I mean, what is the bottom line? What I see is that various religious entities can still do more also internally, inside the churches or the whatever mosques and so on. And in addition to continue the good work, I think the challenge is for some is the whole prevention agenda. We know that. And so be it, but I think that continuing dialogue is necessary. But that's... In my view, this is kind of an irreversible element now of the... It's a given in our movement. It's just like people living with HIV. I mean, it's hard to imagine not to have it. Janet, on gender, okay, recommendation for my successor is what I've started, and that doesn't mean it's the right thing to do, but is work internally in a quite aggressive way to make sure that we are a gender literate force, let's put it that way. And your paper helped certainly a lot on that. Because it's not enough to have a gender specialist or a gender team. That's often the best excuse for not to have to deal with it for the rest of the organization. And so you need that also, of course. You need a group of champions to move the agenda. But we're investing a lot in that internally,
so that, one, everybody feels comfortable with it. Two, that it's not only women who talk about gender, which is kind of a, when was this, last year or so, we had some interdepartmental, you know, this task force on gender, blah, blah, blah. And then I saw the list of, it was 100% women. And I said, I returned the list. I said it should be 50-50. So that would be one thing. And then the second issue is very concrete operational action. It's not enough to say gender is important and so on. That's not enough. I mean, and you know all that. And so working further on operationalizing the gender agenda so that it's very clear these are the three things we have to do. Because otherwise it's not going to work, I think. Thank you.
Thank you. Peter, on behalf of everyone here, I want to thank you for being with us. So please join me in thanking Peter.